It's a honking car on the side of the road. No one can blame them. This goes on for another 2 hours. Things are looking grim. They look behind them, and that van that they thought was empty, sitting a block away, is suddenly a lot closer than it was. There's also someone in it. All they can do is watch this future murderer become inspired. They keep an eye on him while honking at every car that goes by. Then the girls truly lose their minds when the van starts to move. They watch this big old nondescript van slowly head their way, and they are certain it will be what kills them. They look to the old restaurant parking lot, and now there's a car there, also slowly headed for them. This makes 2 cars where there were none, and now a third car is pulling up next to them. Before they know it, they are surrounded by 3 cars. They are going to die. A man gets out of the van to, they assume, kill them. He stands next to his van for a while, just staring at them before approaching their car. Goodbye, cruel world. He knocks on the window and Lacey yells, "We are not rolling down this window." He keeps knocking on the window and their conversation goes like this. Scary guy. "What are you doing here?" Idiot children. "What do you think we're doing here? This car doesn't work. It died." Scary guy. "You're lying. We saw your car move." Now remember, they've been sitting here for hours, freezing in a car that is off. If this man saw the car move, he has been watching them for hours. Scary guy. "Are you waiting for drugs? What are you doing here? We saw the car move." Idiot children. "That was a long time ago. No one waits for drugs in the middle of nowhere for hours." Scary guy proceeds to pull out a walkie-talkie, discusses this situation with the people in the other 2 cars. After a short, stupid discussion, he says, "We're with the Council Bluffs Mad Dads. We can get you guys some help. We can drive you to the gas station." Now, I'm not in charge of the Mad Dads, but I have never, and I mean never, seen a group of Mad Dads who were white. And I kind of feel like they were Mad Dadding wrong. The Omaha Mad Dads wanted to protect their community, but it seemed like the Council Bluffs Mad Dads wanted to catch some black people. This man watched 3 teenagers almost freeze to death on the side of a road, hoping that he could watch a drug deal go down. And then God knows what he would have done. Seriously, what if our dad had come to save them and this old van-driving, dumb-as-rocks, walking turd saw it? He could have done anything. Anyway, Scary gives the all-clear into the walkie-talkie. They look behind them to the van, and a wife and 2 kids pop up. This man brought his family to what he thought was a drug deal. They were so excited at the thought of catching drug dealers that they let 3 teenagers freeze in a car for close to 3 hours. Learning is fundamental. Before Lacey started working at the Girls Rehabilitation Community, they had to take a psychiatric behavior training class. This would be a great opportunity to learn how to give the children what they need and be able to understand them better. Lacey, big nerd, was excited to learn. Their instructor was a middle-aged white guy who couldn't hide his ignorance when talking to POCs in class. He'd walk in, give a completely normal greeting to everyone, but when he was talking to minority students, he'd be like, "Yo, yo, yo, you got your assignment?" Or, "Yo, yo, yo, you gonna be here tomorrow?" The second this started, Lacey wasn't having any of it. This isn't the most uncommon occurrence. She didn't let him act this way for 1 minute because it's truly the most annoying thing. Here's some examples. Now, when a person like this is talking to your classmates and they say, "Hello, everyone," what they say to you is, "Yo, yo, yo." If what they say to your classmates is, "Oopsie, you miscalculated," what they say to you is, "Bitch, you tripping." If what they say to your classmates is, "Correct," what they say to you is, "You right, you right." If what they say to your classmates is, "Give it a shot," what they say to you is, "It's like you ain't even be trying." If what they say to your classmates is, "Which way to the interstate?" what they say to you is, "How I'm supposed to get home?" If what they say to your classmates is, "We did a good job and hit our goal," what they say to you is, "We winning." Now, not only could Lacey not stand being talked to like this 3 times a week for the next 8 weeks, but she noticed there were a lot of young black kids just starting out in this class with her. They shouldn't have to deal with this fool. She told him he couldn't continue like this. "It's ignorant and offensive. I realize you're trying to be cool. It's not. Talk to us like you talk to everybody else." He did not like that at all. Oh, well, she wasn't there to make him feel comfy in his ignorance. She was paying money for this class, And anytime I'm paying you money, basic respect better be included. It quickly became clear to Lacey that this man was in no way qualified to teach this class. He was a next-level dum-dum. He would teach them made-up facts. It got so bad, Lacey would record him so that we could all listen and laugh. My favorite thing this guy ever said, and the straw that broke the camel's back, was this. He once was trying to explain the difference between the prefixes supra and super. Now, I don't know if you're about to Google the word supra, but this teacher didn't. He told a class full of adults a made-up definition to an actual word. Personally, I would have leaned in enthralled, but Lacey was livid. He then said the dumbest thing any human being has ever said. He told the class that supra came from the word supracalifragilisticexpialidocious. He said supra meant above, and that's why Mary Poppins always held the umbrella above her head. I mean, there's like a million insane things in that line of thought, but I'm just going to say this. Where else could you possibly hold an umbrella? Below? Also, it's not supracalifragilisticexpialidocious. It's supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Now, this may sound like this man had some real problems, but it was more that he wanted to hear himself talk, and he thought he didn't need to follow along with the curriculum. All he had to do was read aloud from the book or tell them to do that themselves, and he would have been saved. Side story. Lacey had a black friend whose nickname was Odo, but her whole name was Odomichi. The two of them were at a gallery opening. It was a fancy gathering full of fancy people. A woman introduces herself to the two of them and asks what Odo is short for. Odo replies, Odomichi. The woman is floored. Not only is that an impossible name to say, but it's also insane. She's yelling about it and going on and on. Multiple attempts to say it correctly. She can't. It's as hilarious to her as it is impossible to say. It's like a crazy African name. She goes on and on and on. Lacey laughs along and goes, oh, yeah. It's like, what's that song in the Mary Poppins movie? The one that's really hard to say. And the woman, without missing a beat, goes, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. And Lacey says, that's right. Now, how in the world is that so easy to say? But Odomichi, a four-syllable word, is not. It's almost like you want to get it wrong. The woman sees her mistake, but it's too late. Silenced, she skulks away. Now, back to the story. Lacey was furious that she spent money on listening to the ramblings of a crazy person when she could have been learning things that help her in her job taking care of children. She, along with many other students, went to the office, told them about his excessive use of the word yo, and complained about his making up his own facts. Lucky for her, she had recorded his supra rant. She played it for the people in the office, and they couldn't believe their ears. They must have talked to him, because the next day in class, he tried to get his revenge. He announced that they were going to learn about different cultures and their behaviors. First, we're going to learn all about black culture. He walks up to the TV in the front of the class, and with a smirk, he puts on the movie Boys in the Hood. Most of the class, including several white students, walked out. They go to the front office again and make their complaint. They can't believe he's showing a movie instead of following the curriculum. He is immediately fired. But the real end of the story, and the part that makes it one of the best stories of all time, is the three students that stayed in the room later told the rest of the class that in the middle of the movie, a porn started playing. Not only was he disrespectful enough to show them Boys in the Hood, talk about this is how you learn about black people, but he was disrespectful enough to use his tape of that movie, which everyone agrees is a masterpiece, to record porn. He ran up to the TV and shut it off as fast as he could and ended class early. Let's take a break and have some more silly stories. No, this is where we're at now, and it will only become more unbelievable. It's time for some real doozies. Now, you'd think the stories in this chapter were plot points in a bad movie. And they are! Lacey and the Whites, coming to theaters this fall. Coworker quotes. Not things I heard, things white people said directly to Lacey's beautiful face.
Omaha has some really racist gangs. In a meeting, someone said, a lot of the times when you take braids down, you'll find roaches in them. I was wearing braids in this meeting. Well, I was fired by a woman who didn't pay me enough and always hired, a certain ethnic group. I'm the only Black person in the room. Inner city kids shouldn't get fireworks. Their parents should spend their money on paying their bills and feeding their kids. Lacey, I started watching a show on Netflix about a Black kid playing basketball on her scholarship. I'm just trying to learn more about you. Well, I'm 5'2 and high maintenance, so I don't think it's me you're learning about. We had a Black coach at school. He had a bald, lumpy Black head, so we called him Milk Dud, and he didn't like it. I was going to vote for Obama, but then I found out he was going to paint the White House purple, so I didn't. There has to be something in the Asian DNA to make them look and become so smart.
Muslims burned down Notre Dame.
It has to be. Oh, I didn't know your sister Amber wasn't gay. She just reads gay. I mean, I should know. This was said by the lady at work who has to tell you she's gay every half hour in the hopes that she can say inappropriate Black stuff. But that's not how it works. Just because I only have vanilla cupcakes doesn't mean I'm racist. Hey, I liked chocolate back in the day. I used to swing in the jungle. This was also said by the lady at work who has to tell you she's gay every half hour in the hopes that she can say inappropriate Black stuff. But that's not how it works. Make sure you vote tomorrow so we can keep Trump in office. I'm Native American, and it was the Mexicans who put Native Americans in concentration camps, not white people. A confused white person. There's a horde of MS-13 gang members on their way here to kill us. Me. My African dance troupe is performing this weekend, so come out if you want to have fun. Anne Marie. Oh, I don't know if I would like that. Me. Why not? Anne Marie. Because don't you guys perform naked with tambourines?
Sally, the coworker with the loudest, dumbest beliefs. These are all stories about Lacey's coworker, Sally. Now, Sally wasn't the most racist coworker or the loudest coworker, but what she was a perfect mix of the two that guaranteed daily unease. Please imagine a no-nonsense mother of five with chunky highlights and lowlights in her Long Island medium haircut. The type of woman who wears shorts when it's cold. The type of woman who will keep your conversation going no matter what room she's wandered off to. Not the kind of woman who will send her meal back at a restaurant, but the kind of woman who will have fun with your kid when you bring him into the office. The type of woman who will announce loudly to the room when you come in a new shirt. When music plays, she sings along at full volume. If you're sad, you can talk to her, and she'll be eager to provide some comfort and bring you a cupcake later. I give this long description just as a reminder that very racist people aren't always easy to spot. So here are things a lady who most people would describe as a delight said. Lacey went to lunch with Sally and another white coworker. As they're driving through the parking lot in a strip mall connected to a grocery store, Sally sees a Black woman pushing a cart of groceries. Just a regular woman pushing a cart of groceries to her car. Sally sees this and says, "Oh God, it must be the first of the month." That was her reaction to a Black woman trying to shop. We need to stop hiring Black people. The ones we have are just ghetto, ghetto, ghetto. Lacey, I'm not talking to you. I like you. Sally could not stand the Amish, Mormons, and minorities. The Amish are destroying this country. They rape the land. This woman said the land is being raped. They get land from the government that they don't deserve, and then they rape it. What in the world could she possibly mean by that? Does she mean that they start farms and work the land? Does she think work means rape? Sally's friend Kate would chime in on her racist comments and say, "The time is coming soon where we'll just build a commune, and I'll be the first to defend it. I'll be the one standing there with a rifle. I won't ask questions. If you step on my property, I will shoot." These two women were supervisors.
Think about being a 19-year-old Black CNA. You have to listen to comments like these all the time. You cannot make these comments and have a job in America.
If you're listening to this and you or someone you know makes comments like these at work or anywhere, please contact the Sally and Kate Commune. They have a lot of room and no real plan. Read more about it at www.unpopularcommune.com.
The No-Nos. Here's a few unlikable stories.
I call them the no-nos because as Lacey was telling me each of these, I was holding my head in my hands, peeking through, saying, no, 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 no. Asian mom. Lacey is talking about this very book with a lady she met at a party. She has two Asian sons who are adopted. Lacey said, I'm sure you deal with these kind of ignorant comments all the time because people say all kinds of things about Asians. In fact, do you know what a coworker of mine once had the nerve to say to me about Asians? She said, you can't tell them apart. There's no way to know if they're male or female. Isn't that insane? How could someone ever come to that conclusion? This woman's reply was unbelievable. So to make it easier to digest, I've taken what she has said sentence by sentence and marked each one with a corresponding number of racistness so that you can make sure to know how Lacey is feeling as this reply hits her ears. 1 is not racist, and 10 is very racist. Ready? Okay. This white mother of two Asian kids said, well, actually, Asians do look alike. Now, she's saying here that the thing Lacey explained to her as racist is not racist. I'm gonna go ahead and call that a 10 right out the gate. Different ethnic groups look alike, like Chinese and Japanese people look like one another, then Vietnamese and Thai people look just alike. Okay, interesting move. So at this point, she could have backpedaled and said, I mean, people who are from the same country look alike. But she didn't. She said the opposite of that. She basically said, not only do Asians look alike, here's proof that I've spent time thinking about it. I would also call this a 10. Sometimes it's hard to tell them apart with their slanty eyes. You guessed it, she pulled back the corner of her eyes to demonstrate. It's even hard to tell if an Asian person is male or female because Asian men wear a lot of pinks and pastels. And that's confusing for a lot of Americans. Now, I know that last quote took some twists and turns, but each individual word of that sentence is a 45. Normally, Lacey would walk away from such insanity, but this woman has Asian children that she's saying God knows what to. When Lacey tries to explain that no one can look at a white person and go, you're from Finland and I can see that, so why do they expect to do the same with Asian people? What is that? If you can't tell whether someone's from Germany or Denmark, then maybe all white people look alike. Anyway, when Lacey tries to convince her that she's just spouted a series of ever-increasingly racist things, this woman says, well, we'll just have to disagree. Some party. STEM! Lacey's child's school had a meeting for teachers and parents of girls involved in STEM. They were talking about the importance of young girls being introduced to math, and most importantly, how they're introduced to it. Lacey said she's always been bad at math, and the speaker said, that's not true. Someone told you that. The black woman leading the talk told the parents that women, black women especially, have been told in school that they're bad at math. All the black women there nod their heads and begin telling stories about how all their teachers came to the same conclusion, that they're bad at math. Lacey told this story. In elementary school, Lacey always thought she was good at math. She always got great grades. She was consistently the teacher's pet and was eager to do a good job. Now, in elementary school, when you're super smart, the only way to know is your grades. There aren't any special classes or groups or anything. But on the first day of seventh grade, Lacey got to take honors math class. Finally, she would get to be in the smarty pants class with smarty pants children just like herself. She could be the true nerd she was always meant to be. Lacey walked confidently into honors math class. Like all classes, she sat in the very front. The reason for this is threefold. I used to do it too. 1, because we have poor eyesight. 2, so we don't get distracted by kids goofing off. And 3, so teachers can see how perfect we are. The extreme nerd in her would have it no other way. In this class, she was the only black girl, but that's not a scary thing yet, not in the seventh grade. In ninth grade, you may realize the situation you're in, but in seventh grade, it's still all fun. So on this first day of honors math class, the teacher began by calling students up one by one to do problems on the board. Some got it right, some didn't. When they got it right, the teacher gave a loud, satisfying, that is correct. And when they got it wrong, he would say, that is incorrect. And then he would explain what exactly went wrong. He wasn't too mean about it. It was just a way to get rid of some common mistakes early on. Lacey wasn't scared because so far she knew every answer to every problem. Even in the best of the best nerd class, it's the validation she always craved. When it was Lacey's turn, she went up to the board and easily solved her problem. She put the chalk down, went back to her seat. The teacher checked her work, and instead of saying, that is correct, he said, wait, come back. I need you to solve this one.
Lacey knew some shit was about to go down. He had done this to no one else, and she knew something wasn't right. She also knew this man was not happy that she solved it. She also knew why. Even in seventh grade, you know why. But Lacey's only a seventh grader. She's unbroken. After being praised in elementary school, she thought she was the shit. It was on. He put an even harder problem on the board, one much more difficult than everyone else's had been to this point. She solved it. She waited for her, "That is correct," but she got no such response. He heaved a heavy sigh. This man is clearly upset. A child doing a good job at what he has asked them to do has made this grown man mad. He then puts a math problem on the board, the likes of which Lacey has never seen before. Lacey looks back to the class. Not a single face seems to register this is odd behavior. She looks back at the teacher's gross smirk. He won. Lacey just looked at him and said, "I don't know how to solve this." He said, "That's what I thought. Now go take a seat in the back." Lacey moved her stuff to the back of the class, and she never raised her hand in that class. The teacher never asked her another question, and she never offered any answers. Thus began her fear of math. She never took another honors math class again. Lacey even began skipping math class, but I'm not supposed to write that part in the book, so if you see her, pretend you don't know. Once, while at parent-teacher conferences, Lacey told one of her child's teachers that story, and he cried. He cried real tears. He kept loudly repeating, "That's horrible!" And then, and this is not a joke, he showed her how smart she was by giving her a few math problems on the board. All of these questions were AP algebra questions, and she solved them easily and wondered what could have been. The speaker at the STEM talk said, "Never tell a black woman she is bad at math." She then opened up the conversation, and this bunch of black women were heard and encouraged. See, good stuff happens too. In fact, the next book is just going to be all the times we were affirmed in our experiences as black women. It'll be one short-ass book. Cotton gin! So, by the time Lacey got to high school, she pretty much knew the score. She could see the world for what it was and even understood that she could use this time as a high school student to try to make a difference. Lacey went to a high school in downtown Omaha. It was probably 25% black. Lacey was a part of a group of kids who got together to ask if they could have a black history class. They expected an instant no, but instead the school had 50,000 meetings about it. Student council, school counselors, vice principal, principal, student rally meetings, all kinds of stuff. All to talk about why it would be beneficial. Y'all, they couldn't figure out why black history class would be beneficial. They would have these meetings in the middle of the school day and before and after school. After one of the meetings in the middle of the school day, the kids returned to class. Lacey and three other black students returned to their history class. They walk into Mr. Langland's class, and everyone's silently reading. There were only a few minutes left of class, so it must have been free reading time. Mr. Langland sees them arrive, stands up, and says, "Turn your books to page 129. This is odd that he just shot up like that, but okay. They do what he says. There's a small paragraph at the bottom of the page. He only reads the first sentence of it. "Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin." There. There's your black history. He slammed his book down on his desk and sat back down. Side note, Mr. Langland was a very scary person, and so was his wife. She was a teacher at Lacey's elementary school, and although she never had her as a teacher herself, it was common knowledge that she was an actual witch with superpowers. Now, I have no proof of this, but also, I have no proof that this is not true. Word on the playground was that she was one of those witches that could cast spells and loved to torture children. Everyone knew that when you walked near Mrs. Langland, you had to cross your fingers or she would turn you into a frog. President! In high school, Lacey was helping Tasha, a black girl, run for class president. Their group of friends were all sitting in the common area along with everyone else who was running for student government. There was an hour given to all candidates to make their posters during the school day. Tasha is the first black girl at this high school to run for president. Surrounded by white kids and their friends making posters, Tasha and her black crew are feeling proud of her, sitting at the table, hard at work. One of the counselors comes over. "What are you doing here?" "Making posters." "This is only for kids who are serious about running for class president. I need you to leave. This isn't for kids who just want to miss class." The girls are sitting there with a pile of posters, markers, and poster board. They're clearly making posters. This counselor went on and on. It escalated.
Now, Tasha was the type of girl to run for class president. She wasn't about to take this lying down. The counselor got angry. He took the poster board they bought, folded it in half, and threw it out. Lacey, still a stone-cold do-good nerd, had never seen an adult act like this. It scared her, and she left. She's not proud of leaving her friends there, but she did. That counselor was scary. A white kid won class president. It didn't take long for her to figure out how the system worked. She began constantly protesting racism at her school. 25 years later, a white woman walked up to her in the supermarket and said, "Hey, weren't you that girl who wore the 'racism is an illness, are you sick?' shirt at school all the time?" Yes, yes, she was. The drama of Miss Bell! Lacey's always been into the arts. Painting, singing, acting. I think every ruffin is pretty artsy. In high school, Lacey thought it was time to try being in plays and musicals. There was only one problem. The drama teacher was an awful human being. Lacey's best friend in high school was Mario. Mario and Lacey loved drama class and musicals. They would rent musicals from Blockbuster and watch them. They would get together and watch PBS musical specials. You know, it was Omaha, so they had to make do. The two of them noticed that every musical at their high school would have no black people in it. If you were black, you had no hope of getting the lead role. It was just an understood fact. So, facts be damned, they decided to try out for the lead. Who knows? Maybe they would have a chance. The drama teacher did like the two of them, which is more than they could say for a lot of people. So, they auditioned for the lead roles in the school play. They read the lead roles in their audition and nail it. Who knows what'll happen, but they feel great about the job they did. The next day, they post the results. Lacey and Mario, even though they auditioned for the lead roles, were cast as servants. That's not what they auditioned for. They were disappointed. They approached Miss Bell and asked why they were cast as the servants. She proudly replied, "Because when you auditioned for them, you did such a great job." Lacey said, "We didn't try out for those roles. Do you even remember what we read?" They called her out in front of everyone. After class, she asked them to stay behind. "Don't you ever question my authority again. Don't you realize if you were to move to NYC right now, you would never get the main roles in a show? This is the best you will ever get. You should be glad I let you play the servants." At this point, Lacey and Mario are too old to take this lying down. They take the complaint to the principal. In their meeting is Lacey, Mario, the principal, a counselor, and Miss Bell. They're all sitting around a big table. Lacey and Mario repeat everything Miss Bell said to them. The principal and counselor find this unbelievable. You can see on their faces. "I know Miss Bell, and she's too sweet a soul to say anything like this." Before they can say anything to that effect, Miss Bell starts crying. "Why would you say that? How can you pretend I would say something so terrible?" Without missing a beat, Lacey applauds her and says, "Bravo. I guess that's why you're the drama teacher." It was her word against theirs. Lacey and Mario were never cast in a play or musical. A quick note about white tears. Why? Why do they work so well? It's truly a great defense against being called a racist. I mean, it doesn't work for black people. Can you imagine if black people cried every time we were called a name? Every time we were accused of something we didn't do? I tell you what, I would be carrying around tissues at all times. Not only just when I go to see musicals. I think when a white person accused of racism cries, people think, "Oh no, I need to fix this. White people shouldn't cry. They should never have to cry." I think when white people see white people cry, they relate and feel sorry for them. And when white people see black people cry, they can't relate. Even though black people have like a billion things to cry about. Maybe it just boils down to the fact that white vulnerability is a value and black vulnerability puts the black person in danger. I didn't expect this book to get this deep, y'all. Dang. We're ending up at unexpected places all over this book. Let me raise my margarita. To the journey! Fun stories about kids! Danita. Lacey's best friend from kindergarten through the fifth grade was Danita. A very nice little white girl who lived down the street. When they were five, Lacey and her other best friend, Laura, a little black girl, found Danita sitting on the swings all alone, and they immediately became the Three Musketeers. They had a whole elementary school career together until one day, in the fifth grade, as Lacey was leaving their house, Danita's mom said, "I think it's time Danita spends more time with friends that look like her." The three of them never hung out together again.
I wonder if Danita was sad or if she was like, good, I've been needing some new friends.
The summer arts program.
When Lacey was in the fourth grade, she got to go to the gifted summer arts program. It was this really cool summer course where kids who were extra talented artists would go learn things about art that they didn't have the time or resources to teach you about in elementary school. It took place in this big, beautiful classroom with tables instead of desks. It had three teachers instead of one, so everyone got a ton of special attention. The geek in Lacey was so excited. She arrived with a backpack full of special art supplies mom bought her. She arrived early and chose a spot at a table in the front of the class. All the children laid out their supplies. Each kid had bought different supplies, but everyone had crayons, and that's where Lacey had them beat. Lacey didn't have ordinary crayons. She had a big, brand new box of Chubbies crayons. Chubbies had just come out and no one had them yet. By having them, Lacey was truly stunting on these hoes. As we were writing this, I told Lacey I didn't remember what Chubbies crayons were, and she got mad. If you had to Google it too, tweet at me, Amber, it's okay that you didn't remember it. And if you did remember what Chubbies crayons were, tweet at Lacey, Lacey, it's okay Amber didn't remember it, but do go Google it because they are cute. Lacey perfectly organizes everything on her table. She takes great care to set the Chubbies out in the upper left-hand corner, a perfect place. Before class starts, one of the teachers, let's call her Crayon Karen, walks around and greets every child. But when she got to Lacey, instead of greeting her, saying hello, or making sure she felt welcome, Crayon Karen came over and snatched Lacey's Chubbies off of her table and snarled, "Where did you get these crayons from?" Lacey, a friggin' child, replied, "My mom bought them for me." The teacher ignored the answer and, Chubbies in hand, walked away. She proceeded to ask every white student if the Chubbies belonged to them. At this point, Lacey was crying. The class hadn't even started yet, and this woman had made a little girl cry. But Lacey knew redemption was coming, because when the class was over, she would get to tell Mom. Crayon Karen ended up returning the unclaimed crayons to Lacey, without an apology, of course, and starting her class. Little baby Lacey was fuming mad. She went home and told Mom what happened, and Mom calmly said, "I'll take care of it tomorrow." Now, if you don't know my mom and you calmly heard her say she'd take care of it tomorrow, you might think she didn't care at all. But what Lacey knew was that Mom was livid and was going to hurt some feelings. Mom parked the car the next day and walked Lacey into class. Before they walk into the classroom, Mom says to Lacey, "Let me see your backpack." Mom proceeds to go up to each staff member and tells them about the items in her backpack. "This is Lacey, my daughter. These are her crayons. The items she brought with her in this backpack belong to her." The first two teachers think, "What an odd thing to say, but do your thing." When she walks up to the last teacher, Crayon Karen, and says it, she's dumb enough to make the mistake of replying, yes, I see that. We figured that out yesterday." Mom has her idiot. "Did you? Did you get to the bottom of that mystery? Well, if you couldn't tell they belonged to Lacey by the fact that they were on her desk and came out of her backpack and she told you so, I thought you would need to hear it from me before you waste everyone's time again by accusing little girls of theft." Crayon Karen smartens up and says nothing. She's scared, and she should be, and it feels great. Mom walks Lacey to her table, watches as she lays out all her stuff, and eyeballs the teachers hard. They act right for the rest of the summer.
A lot of these stories end badly, but watching Mom tear into this lady was one of the most satisfying things of all time. Listen again, imagine it vividly, and store it in your mind to replay the next time you're in the mood to watch someone get their comeuppance.
Scary Art Man.
In high school, there were two art teachers, a nice one and one that was comically mean. Luckily, Lacey had the nice art teacher. There was so much interest in art that the two art classes would take place next door to one another at the same time. That's right, listener. Public schools used to have art classes. One day, while Lacey is sitting safely in the comfort of her normal art class, the mean teacher bursts in. He walks into Lacey's class, points directly at Lacey, and he says, "You, come out here now. Follow me." Lacey is terrified. The mean art teacher has her now. She wouldn't survive much longer. Mean art teacher takes her to the front of his completely white class and says to her, "Face the students." He gives this short art lesson using Lacey. He says, "This is the face of the Negro. This is what the Negroid race looks like. They have a big nose and full lips. Their skin can be light brown to almost black. When you're drawing a Negro, it should look something like this. Lacey stood there mortified. Go back to class now. She walked back to her class in shock. Can you imagine if that guy had been Lacey's teacher? She'd probably be insane by now. Just kidding, she'd be fine. Every other story in this book is proof. Jimmy! The gym teacher, who we all hated at school, also worked at the bowling alley. We didn't live that far from it, so we would go there to hang out or bowl or have a hot dog. Our brother, Jimmy, absolutely loves video games, and he would go there to play them as much as he could. One day, Jimmy took a bunch of coins to the bowling alley. Nothing special about the coins, mostly quarters with some silver dollars or 50-cent pieces mixed in. When he paid for his food with those coins, Mr. Gym Teacher called the cops because he had never seen a silver dollar or a 50-cent piece. He accused Jimmy of using counterfeit coins. He accused a child of inventing a special denomination of coin, minting it, and using it to buy hot dogs. When I think about this, I wonder, how in the fuck did this man, the dumbest human being alive, have two jobs? The kicker is, the cops brought Jimmy home. Jimmy had to cut his time short at his favorite place because some idiot had never seen 50-cent pieces before and decided to call the cops on a little boy. And for reasons that include but are not limited to racism, the cops put a child in their car and brought him home instead of telling the idiot gym teaching cashier that he owed this child an apology. Now, this book isn't about Jimmy, but I could talk about him all day. Jimmy is a video game comic book nerd. Once in high school, he had left fireworks in his backpack and they were found by the principal or a counselor or whatever that lady was. He had no idea they were in there and wasn't planning on setting them off at school, but it was against the rules to have them there. So the lady sent Jimmy to spend 2 weeks at a juvenile delinquent school downtown. Those kids broke Jimmy's collarbone. If this lady knew anything, she would have been able to see that coming. But she didn't, because when she looked at Jimmy, she saw someone who belonged at that school instead of the king of nerds and someone who forgot he had fireworks in his backpack. This lady is my friend's mom's friend, and I will always truly, madly, deeply hate her guts because, and I don't think this needs to be said, but if this were a little white child she was friends with, she would not have sent him there. The actually scary story. Okay, when Lacey was 5, she was walking to the grocery store with our 2 older sisters. On the corner of our street was an old rundown house, an old man who you almost never saw lived there. It was known as the Old Man House. The old man's lawn was crazy overgrown. It had a lot of weeds and vines and stuff, and it spilled over onto the sidewalk. As they were walking by, our sister Angela's shoe got caught in the weeds, even though she was on the sidewalk. That's how bad this lawn was. Angie bends down to free her shoe from the lawn and retie it. The old man sees them and comes outside. He is enraged. He's yelling at them to get off of his property. No one's on his property. They were all on the sidewalk. Angie, even though she is so young, is completely unbothered. Still shouting, he walks right up to Angie. Angie stands up, toe to toe with this old man. He's tiny, so they're about the same size. Angie has both of her fists clenched as she looks this screaming old man in the eye. She's waiting for this bitch to make a move. He's a billion years old and has decided to scream at children. But, okay. In her face, he shouts, "N-word, get your foot off my lawn." Again, she was on the sidewalk. Lacey was frozen in fear, but Angie just looked right up at him and said, "Your lawn reached out and grabbed my foot. If you took better care of it, people would be able to walk down the street." She hadn't budged an inch. She looked at him like, "Feeling froggy, bitch?" Fun fact about Angie, she ain't no punk. Angie stared this old man down so friggin' hard that he walked away from her. Terrified, they continued to walk to the store. They crossed the street and turned the corner, so they're still in front of his property just across the street. The old man is shouting from his yard, following them, shouting, "N-word, go back to where you came from. Go back to where you came from." Lacey looked at Crystal, the oldest, and said, "Let's just go home." Crystal replied, "When he says go back to where you came from, that's not what he's talking about." The old man was yelling things like, "You don't belong here," and, "You're going to get in trouble." Now, it's funny that he thought they didn't belong here. The neighborhood wasn't black yet like it is now, but it was browning up pretty nicely at that point. He must have seen the blackening of the neighborhood and thought, I'll scare some kids. That'll send a message. As they ignored him, the old man, furious that he wasn't getting the attention or fear he felt he deserved, went back into his house and reappeared on his porch with a shotgun. He got out a shotgun to defend himself from the 5, 8, and 10-year-old children who were, at this point, directly across the street. They didn't run or scream. They just stood there staring at him. They may have encountered racism before, but this was something new. A freaking shotgun! A double-barreled shotgun, like from the cartoons. Truly a weapon as old as his beliefs. He's shouting, pointing the shotgun, and his wife comes out the front door, crying and screaming for him to come inside. He raised the shotgun, aiming it at them, while his wife kept pulling down his arm, pleading for him to go back inside. Lacey's not sure why they stood there or what would have been the best thing to do, but when someone's screaming at you, irate for fun, pointing a gun at you, who knows what the right thing to do is. Lacey is so sure that this is their last moment on Earth. They stood there for what seemed like forever, praying for a miracle, when out of nowhere, a young African-American man pulled up right in front of them and yelled, "Get in the car!" They were raised not to talk to strangers, but this, I think, is the mother of all exceptions. They dove in the car without hesitation, and he took them home. The neighbor with the shotgun lived only 4 houses away from us. The house has since been demolished. Now it's just an empty lot. If you're wondering why no one called the police, stop listening now, take your headphones off, and throw them into the sea. You've learned nothing, and this is not the book for you. This is just one of a billion crazy stories that have happened to Angie. The next book will be all of Angie's stories. There will be no jokes. It will be 1,100 times harsher than most of Lacey's stories. And if that's hard for you to imagine, think of the difference between Hop on Pop and 12 Years a Slave. You will get 4 pages into Angie's book and throw it out the window. And with Angie's luck, it'll hit her right on the head. At this point in the book, there's a picture of a beautiful duckling, and it says, "Say hello to Curtis, the palate cleansing duck." But you can't see the duck. So here is a special audiobook bonus, a palate cleansing song. La 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 la, racism is bad. Yay! White church, the worst place on earth. I'm so sorry about this part of the book. These people are real and probably still at this church. Recently, I saw a headline about one of the pastors who may or may not be mentioned repeatedly in this section. It was an article about how some nut job pastor said America is safe from coronavirus because Trump is anti-abortion. My older sisters got invited to a white youth group. That invitation changed their lives. For many black teenagers in predominantly white spaces, you begin to ignore the racist things people say. I don't know how to describe this, but you're well aware you live in a racist society. You even know that Omaha is out of the ordinary. You kind of report what is egregious and ignore the less insane. But it's such a regular part of life that you've spent a ton of time just rolling with it. You're young, you may not even fully understand how or why you're being discriminated against or what you can do about it. Church is the perfect place for crazy racist behavior because your guard is completely down. It's church. Okay, so white church has a bunch of different youth groups gathering from all over the city, from every corner of Omaha. But the church itself is in Bellevue, a city right outside of Omaha. It's whiter than white. So at this church, Lacey's was the only black youth group. So among the 300 members of the youth group, they stood out. As you listen to these stories, keep all that in mind and try to remember that in between all these stories are a fun group of black and white friends who were great, whose friendships have lasted to this day. Let's explore that 1980s small town dynamic, shall we? Here is a collection of stories from this confusing yet eye-opening time in Lacey's life. How about a fun quote from the pastor of the church to get us started? "Music with drums is satanic jungle beats from Africa. It hypnotizes you to make bad decisions." Jenny! There was a woman named Jenny at church who was the most condescending woman on the planet. One of those white women who truly thought she was down. Lacey is sitting with a group of white people at church. They're talking about talking on the phone all night, and Jenny turns to Lacey and says, "Lacey, there's this thing on your phone, and when you're on a call and a second call comes in, you can just press a button and answer the second call. It probably hasn't reached North Omaha yet." This woman was talking about call waiting. At this point, it had been years since it was invented, and she is a full dum-dum who does not understand how technology works.
She thought advancements in technology are doled out according to race.
She may not have thought you had a phone.
Oh, my God.
I know. If you go out to eat with Lacey, you have to send her the menu ahead of time because it is hard for her to decide what to eat. She's what I call dinner indecisive. One day, she went out to eat with Jenny and some others, and she's taking forever to decide what to eat. Everyone else is like, "Lacey, can't you decide what you want? Hurry up." Then, Jenny comes to Lacey's rescue by saying, "Lacey's probably never been to a place this nice." She turns to one of the guys they're with. "Craig, you're cultured. Why don't you help Lacey by explaining to her what's on the menu? Help her figure out what she wants." Lacey said, "You need to stop talking right now. That restaurant? Olive Garden. The Olive Garden! When you're here, you're condescending." Pastor Frank. It was a large white church filled with white people they were invited to on Wednesday nights. It was a fun youth group type of place. The music was loud and they played games and it was a cool place to be with a ton of people their age. The church had big buses that picked up all the young folks. My sisters and their friends didn't know they were looked down on at first. They didn't know they came from a place that people thought of as bad. Even though the black kids outdressed them by a mile, the kids at this church still thought the black kids were dirt poor. One Wednesday night, a white churchgoer couldn't find her car keys, so Pastor Frank did what any hero would do. He called all of the black youth group in a room and questioned them, pleading for them to give back the car keys. Now, there are 300 people in this church, and they don't know who has the car keys. No one saw anything. That white woman had not come into contact with the black kids, yet they were sure one of the eight of them had the keys. When the pleading didn't work, they tried a new tactic. Pastor Frank said, "We're going to turn off all the lights, and if you have the keys, you can just put them on the table." Pastor Frank and this woman turned the lights out and counted 10. When they turn the lights on again, they look at the table, and it's empty. And they're disappointed. So they try again. Again, there are no car keys on the table. They beg the kids to do what's right and reassure them they won't get in trouble. They try again. Nothing. They did this for a good 15 minutes. The white woman whose car it was crying, utterly distraught. "Please, you guys, we know it's one of you who has them." This ended with someone coming in the room saying, "Your keys are locked in your car." It should be said that none of these black children were even old enough to drive. Lacey had been a regular at church for quite some time when she was pulled out of the sanctuary and told by Pastor Frank, "Someone said they saw you with a gun." Lacey was confused. "A gun? Where? Why would I have a gun? We're at church. What am I going to do, shoot Satan?" They made her turn around and asked, "What's that in your pocket?" These people who have known Lacey for quite some time and know she's a delight all of a sudden thought she turned to a gun-toting life of crime. What would make them think that? Lacey goes, "Why do you think that?" They explained a white woman who had never come to this church before in her life, whom they had never talked to save for this incident, accused Lacey of having a gun, so of course they'd have to search her. She turned around and lifted her sweater and showed everyone her comb handle. Now, if you're asking, what did they say after these events? The answer is not enough. I mean, is there really anything they could say to have any effect on these nutty events? There is not. There is very not. The rest of these hoes. The church would have different Bible studies at people's houses. This happened all the time, so you got to know everyone. It was fun. This week, Bible study was at Lacey's friend Poppy's house. So everyone is in the living room having Bible study. Lacey walks in and sees a butt ton of her friends. The living room is filled with white teenagers and Lacey's Bible group of black teenagers. Poppy's mom sees Lacey's group and says to her daughter, "Poppy, can I see you in the next room, please?" Everyone continues socializing. When Poppy gets back from talking to her mom, she looks distraught. She says to Lacey and her group, "Can I see you guys in the next room, please?" When they meet Poppy in the kitchen, they see Poppy standing there looking ashamed, staring at her feet. She's avoiding eye contact, and something is wrong. "My mom says you don't have to leave, but you do have to stay in the kitchen. You can eat snacks, but you can't come in the rest of the house because you weren't invited." She is very embarrassed to have to say this. Now, this is where normally you would say, "Oh, I'm being treated like shit, so I'm out." But this was an impossibility, as Poppy was the one who drove them there. That's right. Poppy picked them up and took them to a place they were not invited to. Kind of makes you think they were more than invited, but okay. The kids reply, "We'd rather leave." After seeing the look on everyone's faces, Poppy works up the nerve to go back to her mom, and they have it out. Everyone can hear it. It's pretty intense. They wonder if they're going to leave or if Poppy was going to lose the argument. Poppy comes back into the kitchen holding her car keys. She's lost the argument. She takes them home, apologizing all the way, disgusted with her own mother. No one blamed Poppy. It's clear she wouldn't have taken black people to her house if she knew they were going to be embarrassed like that. But joke's on Poppy's mom because Poppy married a black guy. Now, I don't want to encourage you to ever pause this book, but now is a good time to get up, make yourself a drink, and sit back and laugh. Here's a quote from one of the white women at that church. Once she said loudly to the black kids, "Sit down on your butts." Then to her white friend goes, "That's how you got to talk to him." And once one of the white pastors goes, "When I do my ministry in North Omaha, I make sure to have my gun." Back to Pastor Frank. He drove an old Firebird or something along those lines. An old car that he liked for some reason, but was a true piece of shit. Like, if you're a car guy, maybe you would be proud of it, but if you're a regular person, you'd apologize for the fact that people have to look at it. These kids would look at it and laugh because it was a hot mess of a car. Frank would say stuff like, "One day, I hope you guys have a car as nice as this." And, "One day, I pray that you'll move out of North Omaha into a nice place." He said that as if all of North Omaha was bad instead of it being a giant section of Omaha with great and not-so-great neighborhoods. Keep in mind, our parents live in a three-bedroom, three-bathroom house that sits on an acre and a third. Our folks are doing just fine. Pastor Frank lived in a very not-so-great neighborhood in South Omaha in an apartment he shared with three other guys. So this guy really thought he was out here doing friggin' missionary work when he should have been trying to scam a home-cooked meal off of one of our parents. Lacey's 12. Someone from church goes up to her and says, "Hey, you're from North Omaha. What side are you on?" And Lacey replied, "I don't know, the north side." And he said, "No, Crip or Blood."
I said blood and stabbed him.
She did not.
I could have.
That is true. When Bill Clinton was elected, one of the white pastors stood up and said it was a sin to vote for Bill Clinton, and if you did, you needed to come up to the altar and repent. And some people did. I laugh every time I hear that story. Nuts, man. There was a big youth group meeting with like 50 people in it. All the black kids were there. For those of you keeping count, that's 8 black kids and 42 white people. They made an announcement. White women should not come to North Omaha because gang members are being initiated. Now, there's nothing I can say to prepare you for what I'm about to tell you. I need you to take a deep breath before you hear the rest of this story. Maybe take a minute to think about the fact that North Omaha is massive and mostly white. It's also where a lot of the black people are. Are you prepared yet? Okay, one more deep breath. These white people were truly insane. Lord knows how this happened, but this grown man said, "White women should not come to North Omaha because gang members are being initiated. And the way you get initiated into the gangs is by cutting off white women's clitorises." Oh, Lord. Leave those feelings here. Moving on. A black man and a white woman got married at white church, and after the wedding, she told everyone jokingly, "My wedding certificate is like slave documents because I own this Negro now, and if he acts up, I'll just whip him." Everyone, including this man, laughed. Y'all, the joy with which she made this joke truly makes me think this is why she married him. They must have some fucked up kids by now.
Ryan Prout.
The North Omaha Bible Study Group was invited to a small town in Iowa for a retreat. A retreat is typically where your church meets up with a bunch of other churches and goes to a campsite with a few cabins and has church in a new place. Everyone sings songs around a campfire and eats bad food. Dad hears this and is like, "Go if you want, but I am not driving out there to pick you up." My dad is a smart black adult. He knows that this reeks of a bad idea. But there was going to be a speaker there, and all the other kids were going, so he let us go. We arrive, and it was all white people. We're a little sad, but what are you going to do? Then we see the speaker is a black man. Finally, these idiots will get to see an example of a real black man instead of the insane stereotypes these people are walking around with that me and my friends can't seem to put a dent in. Joy of joys. This is an excellent opportunity for some of the racist people that go to this church to get rid of some of the horrible stereotypes they believe and see us for who we really are. We are thrilled. Now, this retreat is a whole weekend, and we still have these white children to deal with, so we calm it down. We choose places to sleep, and as we do, we meet a bunch of white children from bumfuck Iowa. These are children who have never seen a black person in their entire lives. We're scared that it will go poorly, but these kids take to our North Omaha group, and it's a relief. We all giggle and laugh and decide to bunk together. As everyone picks places to sleep, they throw their bags willy-nilly together with ours as we claim a room in Cabin A. We all rush to the big auditorium. It's time to hear the speaker. Dad was wrong. We're going to make new friends and memories to last a lifetime. Friendship! This group of 8 black kids are so proud of this black speaker that we walk all the way up to the front of the auditorium to sit in the very front row. We're beaming with pride as this man starts his speech. He speaks about inner city black youth. Okay. He was talking about it as us versus them. And he was the us. We were the them. It was unbelievable fear-mongering like you have never seen in your life. Not from a black person about black people. Not from a white person about black people. No one. No one has publicly said these things in the presence of black people. Here are some points he made about black people. These people will try to rob you. They'll try to kill you. They are a drain on the economy. He talks about every last stereotype. Then he kind of riles himself up with disgust for black people, saying, "They don't care. They're rude." Once I was at a restaurant and saw a black kid walk through a door and not hold it open for an old white lady. The kid just slammed the door shut. Can you believe it? Did you not see there was a human being there? There's no respect in the black community for people. This man is now visibly upset. It becomes a fire and brimstone sermon, but its only topic is black people and how bad we are. This man recites black stereotypes for the next hour and a half. At the end of his speech, we are embarrassed and ashamed of this man. But we also see why he is so popular. We look around at the people we came here with. They look like they've just heard the juiciest secret of their whole lives. White people ate this shit up. It confirmed all of their deepest, darkest, most racist beliefs. Suddenly, they were justified in treating black people like crap. Dang. Right afterwards, we get up and walk up to Ryan and tell him how his sermon made us feel. I will never forget his reply. He rolled his eyes and said, "Hey, this message wasn't for you. I don't even know why you guys were here." We got up, went back to our room in shock. We looked around, and the white people who were our new best friends 2 hours ago were scrambling to get all of their stuff and move as far away from us as possible. We called Dad. He came to get us.
Amber ruins the book. The cops, they're a riot. Just kidding, they're dangerous and unnecessarily lethal. The whole point of this book is to tell you a bunch of Lacey's stories and have everyone see how crazy they are, but we have to take a break from that for a second. I could not write a book about racism and not include a section about cops, specifically me and cops. So for the next teeny bit, indulge me and pretend you're listening to a slightly more serious book. Maybe it's called something like A Troubled Nation, or it's an essay called The Dangers of Overpolicing. I used to live in Chicago. It was a very fun time in my life where I was the least aware of the world, yet most independent. I took improv classes and interned at a theater and made new friends every day. I lived right down the alley from a police station. My neighborhood, Boys Town, was pretty darn white,
When you're Black, that doesn't make you feel safe. Here's why. I lived in one of those houses that had three apartments in it. Every once in a while, I would enter my house from the alley instead of the front. My bedroom looked out onto the alley, and oftentimes I could spy people making out or straight up getting nasty. One night, my friend Tony, a Black guy, was leaving my apartment. He hopped on his bike and rode off, but had left his wallet. Now, I didn't realize this until I changed into pajamas. I called him, he came back. I stepped out shoeless onto the back stairs and reached down and handed him his wallet. He dropped his bike and walked over to me. Sirens went off. "What are you doing? What's going on over there? Hold it right there." The cop had Tony put his hands on the roof of the car while she patted him down. I explained that he was just here and I live here. She demanded to see both our IDs. We showed them to her. Now, this woman is mad. A lot of the time when you deal with cops, it's not only your job to do what they say, it's your job to de-escalate the situation. A lot of these cops come to you at a 10, and if you want to survive the interaction, you got to get them down to a 6. This woman was at an 8. She runs our IDs and comes back and is still mad. I tell her that I live here. I'm on the back stairs in pajamas and no freaking shoes for fuck's sake. She makes me go inside and get a piece of mail with my name on it. Now, this woman has stopped us for no reason, frisked Tony, ran our IDs, and we have literally done nothing wrong. We're in an alley after dark. She explains to us that Tony was running away from her police car. He ditched his bike to get away from them. He was trying to come into my house before they heroically stopped him. I mean, dude. Many years later, after I had moved to Amsterdam, I came back to Chicago to visit. I'm on my way to pick up my friend Krasny, who lived next door to me in Police Station Alley. Our friend parks at the gas station at the end of the alley so I can run up and get her. I'm friggin' thrilled. I hadn't seen her in years, and we're on our way to have dinner and catch up. Because he's watching me, I skip down the alley to her house, but little did I know, skipping down Police Station Alley is a big no-no. I end up skipping towards a cop car driving down the alley. The sirens go off. A cop gets out and his gun is drawn. "Put your hands on the hood of the car! Put your hands on the hood, now!" I think it's safe to say this man is at a 10. I comply and he pats me down and is livid. It's as if he's just seen me punch a child in the face. This man's anger level towards me is insane. I'm a young, adorable delight, literally skipping down the street, and I've infuriated him. "Where are you coming from?" "Amsterdam." This answer enrages him. "No, where are you coming from right now?" "From the airport, from a flight, from Amsterdam." "Why in the world are you running down this alley?" "I'm not running, I'm skipping. I'm happy to be back in town. I'm going to pick up my friend, Krasny, and take her back to Jeff's car. We're all going to catch up over dinner." I gesture back to Jeff. He's standing outside of his car at the gas station at the end of the alley, watching all of this. He waves. Thank God he didn't come running up to us. He'd have gotten both of us shot. The cop sees that Jeff, a white man, has seen all this and changes his attitude with the quickness. He tells me not to run in the alley. It takes everything in me not to tell him that if I wanted to run in the alley, that would be perfectly legal. Instead, I also gently remind him I was skipping. The cop gets in his car and leaves. I walk away to Krasny's house. Jeff is really bothered by what has happened. I'm not. Shit, that man could have shot me in a second. People who know me would be running around talking about attacking an officer doesn't sound like something she'd do, but the officer said that's what happened, so I guess that's what happened. The second I see my friend, I feel a lot better. We go out and we have a lot of fun that night. It's kind of my duty to have fun if you think about it, because at any time, I could get murdered by the police. My first encounter with the police was in Council Bluffs, Iowa. It's just a city over the river from Omaha. Black people in Omaha always say that our cops are bad, but in Council Bluffs, they're way worse. So I drop off my friend at work in Council Bluffs one morning. I've only been driving for like a year, and I'm in the middle of a lot of morning traffic. I think it's one of those streets that has three lanes both ways. It's the main street that goes all the way through Council Bluffs to Omaha. So I notice that we're all going over the speed limit. I think maybe it's 40 and everyone's going 50. I hate it. But when I slow down, it disrupts traffic. So I go 45. It's only 5 miles over the speed limit, and it's the fastest I'm willing to go. I'm too new to driving, and I'm in Council Bluffs. I'm not really familiar with this place. So to make myself feel better, I turn on Buster.